All the various occupations that are known to Earth are also known and are in action in the spirit world. The artist finds employment with us, the mechanic, all the arts and sciences are fully represented with us as with you, only on a larger and grander scale. Do not suppose that when you lay off your earthly bodies you will cease to be active as spirits, for I tell you you will not. There are no drones in the great hive of there. Spirit world. All are exceedingly active. Yes, the mechanic finds occupation there. All that the soul enjoys to be occupied upon, it will find ample means to reach in the spirit world. Question. Are those who were teachers here, teachers there, or do they change their occupation? Answer. That depends upon whether the teacher here was a teacher in spirit or only in the external. Many are teachers here simply from the force of circumstances. Such abandon the occupation when this life is done, and take up some other that is more congenial. But if such from natural inclination, you may be very sure they continue it beyond this life. Question. Are all who profess to be clairvoyant really so? Answer. Every soul is, to a certain extent, clairvoyant. Clairvoyance is an attribute of the soul, of all souls, some are more largely gifted than others in this respect. Question. Is there as much evil existing in the spirit world as there is here? Answer. There is evil existing in the spirit, you may be sure of that. But I define evil simply as the lesser good. There is not that class of evil existing there that you find here, but there is an outgrowth of the same evil circumstances in the spirit world as here. For instance, the drunkard enters the spirit world as a drunkard. Death does not change him, only it takes away his external shell. It leaves the man precisely the same, and so it is with regard to all the evils or mistakes of life. The spirit world finds you precisely where this lays you down. You do not become a saint upon entering the spirit world when you have left this as a sinner, by no means. Question. What means are taken to correct evil in the spirit world? This was at page 232. Answer. All the various means that human or divine reason can devise. There are no prisons in the spirit world, there are no gibbets. The soul is not forced into the better way through fear, but always through love, and love is always attended by wisdom and justice. With these three angels no soul can, for any great length of time, remain in evil, or in spiritual darkness. The soul who is prone to what you call evil, is slowly and distinctly shown the better. All the consequences of evil are distinctly portrayed to the soul in all their power. And, at the same time, the consequences of a pure and holy life are portrayed to the soul. It instinctively chooses the better way then, and if it is weak, there are plenty who are strong to give the helping hand. There are no Levites in the spirit world. Good Samaritans meet you at every turn. Question. Is ignorance universal on the earth? Answer. It certainly is. It goes hand in hand with wisdom. You may be wise upon certain points, and exceedingly ignorant upon certain other points. Every soul possesses a certain amount, and that amount depends upon the capacities and characteristics of the soul, of wisdom and of ignorance. A Daniel Webster may be very wise so far as Coke and Blackstone are concerned, but very ignorant of the moral law. Question. Several spirits have returned to me and reported that they had been lying in a trance state, or sleep, during their stay in the spirit world, some 4, some 8, 10, or 12 years. Can you explain that? Answer. The soul sometimes remains in a mystified, befogged condition after death. The length of it depends upon the inner power of the spirit to burst the chains of darkness and set itself free. The excessive use of certain stimulants here on the earth will so mystify and befog the spirit that it will remain for days, perhaps weeks or years, in that clouded, uncertain state, neither conscious of their own condition nor of their surroundings. They cannot tell you whether they are on earth or in the spirit world. But when their inner power asserts itself, the mists and fogs begin to disappear. By Theodore Parker, October 19, 1868. Question. Does every person upon entering spirit life become united to a conjugal companion forever, or is the companion changed as his or her condition changes? Answer. Spirits grow and live in accordance with the law of necessity. If a companion is an absolute soul necessity in the spirit land to any individual, you may rest assured a companion can be found and obtained. Some souls grow better alone for a time, while others reach out for that close communion and companionship which is found alone with the male and the female. There is a marriage which belongs to the soul. The soul utters its own ceremonial, makes its own bonds, and breaks them whenever the law shall so determine. Now do not suppose that any condition of being, whatever it may be, whether marriage or the contrary, is eternal, everlasting, for you are all creatures of change. You pass from one condition to another by virtue of the law of necessity that governs you as individuals. Some rise by one process, and some by another. Some, in order to rise, go down into the valleys of despair, and thus gain power to rise, while others have no need of going there. No two souls unfold by exactly the same process. Every soul has its own inherent process of unfoldment, its own inherent law, and it obeys that law to the letter. There is no trespassing upon it, no setting it aside, no breaking it. All must succumb to the law of their being. If the law says a companion is a necessity, the law will provide it. Now you may be very sure of that. Here in this life you are cramped and confined by conventionalities that are not known in the spirit world. They belong to the things of time, and when you are done with time, so far as this, your human life, is concerned, you are done with these crude conventionalities. You pass into a clearer mental atmosphere, you enjoy purer perceptions, you can see farther into the future, and your present is better understood by you. You know better how to choose from your surroundings that which will make you happy. By Theodore Parker, October 20, 1868. Question. To whom should we pray? Answer. The power, the spirit which giveth birth to prayer, will teach us, all, individually, how we should pray. As our prayers are born of divine will, they will reach the source we designed them to reach. The soul prays ever to that which it conceives to be better than itself. It lifts up its sphere of ignorance to the sphere of wisdom. In its weakness, it prays to the source of strength. In its imperfectness, it prays to the perfect source. In its finite perceptions, it prays to the great infinite whole. As the little stream going down the mountainside finds the ocean, so our individual prayers will find the great ocean of infinite good, the eternal presence, the spirit of all good, of all wisdom. It matters not by what name we designate it. Names are of small account, only so far as they are used to represent ideas. We pray to Jehovah as the past, present, and future spirit of all things. There. Brahmin prays to Brahma as the great spirit that he understands. The Indian prays to the great spirit that whispers to him in the winds, that he hears in the laughing waters, that he sees in the falling leaf and in the tempest. And so on through all the catalogue of life, every soul prays to deity in accordance with its conceptions of deity, and all the prayers of the soul never fail to reach the infinite, the all-wise, the perfect father and mother of every soul. By Theodore Parker, October 27, 1868. Question. Why do mediums have to suffer so much in allowing spirits out of the form to manifest? In some cases they become living martyrs. Answer. All that which transcends the usual order of human life must of necessity produce suffering. Those persons who are called mediums are possessed of an extremely sensitive organism. It must be so, because they are sensitive to things beyond human senses. And this exaltation of the nervous system produces, under the slightest inharmonious conditions, pain, distress. If the mental and moral atmosphere surrounding your mediums were perfectly well adapted to the mediumistic life, they would suffer much less, but you are yet in the infancy of spiritualism, the science of life. You do not know as yet what you should do for your subjects, and what you should not do. In your ignorance, you surround them by that which they should not be surrounded by, you take away that which they should have. We do not blame you, because you do not know what is best. And yet, the very misery through which they pass is turned to good again by the great overruling power of life. These dark experiences are made use of by the angel world for good, and some of the brightest of their mediumistic gifts are unfolded in the darkest seasons of human sorrow. These fair blossoms of the soil, alluding to flowers on the table, germinate in darkness, in the crude soil of the earth's crust. By and by the plant comes forth into sunlight, and what is the result? The fair blossom, the tender petals, beauty and fragrance. Use and beauty are the combined, and so it is with your mediums. For instance, look you at a Pierpont. Some of the brightest gems of his intellectual life were born into objective being in his darkest hour of trial. Then remember that hell and heaven are very near to each other, for it is only by the darkness of the one that we are made to perceive and enjoy the other, and again, only by the glory of the one can we know concerning the darkness of the other. There is a power governing all human things, which doeth all things well, and however much our sympathies may be excited because of the many Gethsemanes and Calvaries through which our mediums pass, still, as soon as we are enabled to peer beyond the present and behold the glory of the future, our sympathy and sorrow for their sorrow is in a degree mitigated. By Theodore Parker, November 10, 1868. Question. Do spirits have streams of colored light emanating from the eyes, and other nerve centers? If so, what are their colors? Answer. They certainly do. Every nerve center has its own peculiar light, and that light has its own peculiar color, and the brain combines all the colors of all the different nerve centers. You are physically and spiritually, so far as form is concerned, electrical machines, and because you are constantly exhaling electricity, under all its forms, shadowing forth all its different degrees. This was at page 237. Question. Please give some plain understanding to the circle of the nature of spirit artist control? Answer. There are so many kinds of spirit artist control that I am at a loss to know which kind your correspondent refers to. Chairman, perhaps you can explain the method in which the drawings of Mr. Milson are given. Answer. In that special case, where the mind of the earthly artist is not used, of course the control is mechanical. The thinking power is outside and beyond the earthly artist, while the hand only is used. But sometimes the brain of the earthly artist is largely used, sometimes to a very small extent, just as the controlling influence can best adapt itself to your external conditions. Sometimes it can be done better by controlling the brain, sometimes by cutting off the connection between the brain and arm, and using the arm mechanically. There are so many means by which spirits make themselves manifest, either in an artistic way or otherwise, that it would be impossible to enumerate them all in the short space allotted us. By Theodore Parker, November 16, 1868. Chairman, the following question is addressed to Theodore Parker in spirit life. During the latter part of your earthly life, prayer was instituted throughout the churches of a certain sectarian denomination that God would either convert you or take you out of the world. Is it true that this concentration of many minds acting in unison for a special purpose did produce the desired effect? Was your health affected, or your death hastened, by these unhallowed prayers? Answer. It is a well-known scientific fact that the human body is, to a very great extent, a psychological machine. Because it is itself capable of being acted upon, either for good or ill, by all other minds. If a Dr. Newton or a Jesus of Nazareth could restore a diseased body, giving health through the influence of a psychological law, it is reasonable to suppose that a counter-influence could as well be exerted, and with as much potency. During the last few months of my earthly life, I clearly recognized the baneful psychological influence that had been exerted upon me from the source of which your question treats. As I neared the boundaries of the spirit world, it became more and more clear to me. I did not recognize it in the light of the wrong, but I recognized it as a power used in accordance with infinite law. As I was under the domain of law, not at any time exempt from it, I must bow before its decree. The forest tree falls before the storm. Who shall say it is not well? The lightning shivers the giant oak, and I believe it to be God's decree. Since I have become an inhabitant of the world where law is more understood than here, I have become clearly satisfied that my mortal life was shortened, perhaps many months, in consequence of this psychological influence. Their prayers were heard and answered. It was well. But as the great controlling influence of life makes use of all conditions for good, he made use of this. Every single phase of life, whether greater or lesser good, I believe to be in the hands, or under the guidance, of the great all-wise power of the universe, of all universes, and that what men act upon for seeming evil is always chanced to good. The time is coming when these same persons who acted through their darkness will behold precisely where they stood, and how nearly they were related to justice, and how nearly I was related to justice, in what religious light we both stood. The scales will fall. From every eye in due season, and every soul will be made to understand its relations to every other soul, and to the great God from whence we have all come. By Professor Hare, November 17, 1868. Question. If two children should be born into earth life, possessing equally good physical, moral, and mental organizations, and one should be favored with all the advantages civilization could bestow, while the other should pass into the hands of the wild savage, and both remain on earth 70 years, and then pass into the spirit world, what would be their relative conditions in the summerland? Answer. They would both be pure, but of different degrees of purity, both be wise, but of different degrees of wisdom. It should be known that the external world, the world of form in which you dwell as humans, is perpetually calling out from your spirits their treasures. The external acts upon the internal, and calls out of its beauty. You might be endowed with ever so perfect a physical organism, and ever so perfect an indwelling spirit, but if circumstances and surroundings were not adapted to call out the life within, it would remain within. You may be sure of that. Now, then, while dwelling here, the soul is dependent upon external action, external life, external circumstances for its unfoldment, just as the rose is dependent upon the raindrops, the sunlight, the air, for strength, for power to unfold its inner life to the external. Do you suppose the rose would bloom beautifully in a dungeon? No, it would not. The flowers need sunlight, shade, rain, a dry atmosphere, all the varied conditions of nature, to bring from their inner lives that beauty which they contain. So it is with regard to the spirit. This was at page 240. The child placed among savages would give savage manifestations. The soul might be identical in the two, and so far as it was possible for the physical life to be identical, the bodies might be the same. The same physical lifeline, their twin life, might run through the body, but it is the external difference, the external action upon the internal, that determines the degree, the cast of manifestation of the soul. Now, herein rests a great moral and intellectual lesson. It is this, ye fathers and ye mothers, it is a lesson for you, ye guardians of young minds, you should not pass it by, but know you that just as you call out the beauty of the child's inner life, it will come out. Do not undertake to force any beauty from the external to the internal. There is enough there, call it out. Give the child proper external circumstances, just the very best you can. Call out of the divine that is shrouded in the human, and you will make a most beautiful, spiritual, moral, and intellectual picture, I assure you. Ye who would be artists of the soul, pencil well here, that you may present a beautiful picture of life in the hereafter. Question. Can spirits while in the human form control mediums and communicate to friends at a distance? If so, will the spirit please explain how it is done? Answer. I am very glad that question has been propounded, for it is one that has staggered many minds, but they have failed to understand the truth that they faintly perceive. As I before remarked, spirit governs matter. It is superior to matter, and though it renders to the law of matter, or form, all that is due, it does no more. It should be understood that the spirit, as such, can leave the body at will, and return again at will. If it can do this, it can just as easily communicate through a sensitive organism as can a disembodied spirit. It is nothing unnatural, it is in perfect accordance with natural law, as you will hereafter see, if you cannot today. You go to visit your friends in dreams, you commune with them, you remember, though in broken snatches, that dream. It comes into your external consciousness, to be sure, often as a vagary, yet you generally remember some portions of it. The spirit generally transmits to the external consciousness some remnants, fragments of what it has been passing through in the dream. Now, was the spirit in the body at the time, or was it away with the absent friend? I answer most emphatically, it was away with the absent friend. It may be thousands and tens of thousands of miles away, it may be in the spirit land, it may commune with its dear departed. Know you not that you, as spirits, can enter the soul world, and return again? I tell you you can. And this gift is not bestowed upon a few, but upon every one of you. The smiling infant in its dream meets with the inhabitants of the spirit world ofttimes. Does it go away from the body to hold communion with others? Surely it does. Spirits are acted upon by the law of attraction and repulsion. Suppose, for instance, you have a friend in London to whom you are tenderly attached. That friend may be thinking intently of you. You lie down to rest. The thought of the friend reaches your spirit, and with lightning speed you are there, just as much a spiritual presence as you ever can be. It may be asked, do you take your spirit body with you? Surely you do, you could not go without it, could not make a single impression without it. Now, this will account for the many mysterious messages that have been supposed to come from a departed spirit, when it was afterwards ascertained that the spirit was in the body. There are exceptions, to be sure, to this, as to all other rules. It is by no means impossible for some disembodied spirits to assume to be whom they are not, and thus to impose upon the credulity of human life. I only tell you that this is not only possible to be done, but it is an exceedingly simple and natural process, and quite as easy to be performed as that I speak to you through this sensitive subject. Question. You speak of spirit being superior to matter. What is your opinion of the theory that spirit is itself refined or sublimated matter? Answer. I so believe, but I speak of it in contradistinction to matter, because you have been so educated. You have been educated to divide the two, but, to my own mind, spirit and matter are one and the same, spirit being only a refined degree of matter. Now, you well know that the finer, the more subtle an element is, the more powerful it is. Therefore, if spirit be, as I believe, refined matter, that does not destroy my theory at all, but renders it, if possible, more sure, more perfect. Matter is ever ascending in the scale, and the higher it ascends the more powerful it becomes. It has been said by some that spirit is ever ascending through matter. Very well, call it that. I call it the purer, the subtler part of matter, ever ascending, and the farther it ascends the more it unfolds, the more powerful it is, and the more it can exert great influence over all lower forms. By Theodore Parker, December 3, 1868. Question. Supposing the doctrine of pre-existence true, Is it at the option of the spirit that it returns and clothes itself in another earthly form? Spirit life is described as being far better adapted to progression in holiness and purity, and, consequently, happiness, than earth life. Then why return? Answer. No, it is not optional with the spirit to determine concerning the conditions of being through which it shall pass, and by which it shall progress. Since we have no knowledge of ever having had any voice concerning preexistence, or so far as we, as spirits, are concerned as relating to the present, it is not at all unreasonable to suppose that the same law will continue with us through the future. It has been asserted that the spirit world proper, or the condition of being that is beyond human senses, is better adapted to the unfoldment of the spirit than the conditions to which it is attached in human life. Considered in a certain light, this is true, but in another light, it is untrue. For since we know that we can only gain strength by action, and retain it by action, we know it is best that we be always active. It matters not whether it be in a physical, moral, intellectual, or spiritual sense. If there were no lesser good for the soul to war against, its powers would soon dwindle into insignificance. You may be sure of that. I believe that the experiences through which the soul passes during its journey through human life are absolutely necessary for the welfare of the soul. I believe that certain powers of the soul are brought out better through the hard experiences of human life than in any other way. I believe that the sorrow incident to the earthly life is absolutely necessary to bring out and brighten and glorify the joys of heaven. Talk as much as you may of the better condition, the soul revolves in the spirit world proper, I well know, and thousands, millions of spirits attest to the truth of this assertion, that the soul has need of the darkness of earth life, and as it revolves again and again, as round and round there circle runs, we gain at each revolution something higher, something better. We may pass through all stages of our being, but we part with something of our lesser good by so doing, and we gain some greater good. By Joy H. Fairchild, December 7, 1868. Question. Will you give an opinion with regard to the following extract from Swedenborg's writings? When spirits begin to speak with man, he must beware that he believe nothing that they say, for nearly everything they say is fabricated by them, and they lie, for, if they are permitted to narrate anything, as what heaven is, and how things in the heavens are to be understood, they would tell so many lies that a man would be astonished. Answer. The experience which you, as spiritualists, have passed through during the last 20 years should answer the question. If that cannot, I am in serious doubt as to whether I shall be able to answer it to the satisfaction of even one individual soul. To say that spirits return always telling what is absolutely true to all, would be uttering what is untrue. But to say that they return always bearing falsehood, would be equally untrue. If death finds a man a liar, it does not change him. He enters the spirit world the same liar. He carries with him all that belongs to his spiritual nature. He leaves nothing behind. Death robs him only of the external members through which he manifested. But there are many different ways of defining a lie. Many people decide very unwisely concerning truth and falsehood. We are very apartment to say that a thing is untrue which we know nothing about, which has not been brought to our senses so near that we could recognize it as a truth. We are very apartment to stamp alely upon that which seemeth so to be to us. It is a fault of our human nature, and one which we can only outgrow by experience, by being brought in contact with all the different states of life, and being able to view them all with impartial perception. Swedenborg was a very excellent seer in his day. He was permitted to behold many things that pertain to the spirit life, but he was by no means a perfect seer, for there never was one. He was by no means an infallible clairvoyant, for there never was one. If there was, or if it could be, then the function of seership would cease. Clairvoyance would have reached a state of infinite perfection, which I do not believe it ever can, or ever will. Since round and round the circle of human experience runs, there can be no such thing as absolute perfection in any one sphere of life. We attain wisdom by discrete degrees, says Swedenborg. I believe it. But I also believe that we never can attain the highest wisdom. There will always be something beyond, a state of beatitude that we have not reached, something that we did not know about, something that has not been brought to our comprehension.